Okay, thank you, Andy Manning.
This is my second time at the public health conference here, but I read a lot of you guys' work. I'm all the time in that journal and so on. So I hope you'll find of interest what I have to say today. Both the U.S. and Mexico emerged over the early 20th century as two of the world's leading sources of oil. Yet they built very different political economies for exploiting this resource, with profoundly different consequences for the health and well-being of those regions in each nation that specialized in oil production. Today, I was thinking about a comparative historical study I've been undertaking of just what these differences meant for health as well as the environment and politics. But with this opportunity to address a group called the Spirit of 1848, I'd like to start by reflecting not so much on my case studies as on recent literature. And you can see my title also reflects a little shift in focus. The recent literature concerning a subject about which Rudolf Virchow himself had a lot to say, and that is the relationship between health and democracy. Now, enshrined there in his famous 1848 report on the typhus epidemic in Upper Silesia is a piece of choice, is this choice quote. That in its original, it's even more emphatic, and this is the original up here, but the gist of it is that free and unlimited democracy is necessary for health. Now, it just so happens that democracy has also become a major theme over the last 15 to 20 years in the comparative social science of resource-rich nations, especially in the non-Western world. Kicking off the debates was a 1990s claim emanating from investigations that centered on the Middle East and Africa about nations with large endowments of natural resources, oil in particular. And contrary to what you might initially think and what I grew up thinking as an American historian, natural riches were not so good for nations. They brought a resource curse, not just impeded development, but an inclination toward authoritarianism rather than democracy. Now, just as this literature has often slighted questions of health, so the abstracts for today's session just confirm my sense that public health specialists have largely ignored this debate, despite the claim it has staked on one of Virchow's most fundamental questions. So I thought I'd take my time today to introduce you to this literature and thereby to think through some of its implications for my own cross-national study. So just a preview, much of my talk is literature review. I'll set the resource curse theory over against Virchow's approach, and then I'll turn to my case studies, and there I'll pluck out just one strand of this entanglement between oil, democracy, and health. And this is the one I made progress on in my research, an ongoing, relatively new project, and that is workplace and environmental hazards, and the politics that they generate. Okay. To set Virchow's thinking alongside that of social scientists the last few years is, of course, comparing apples to oranges. Times and context, as well as the frameworks, are just so different. Historians would accuse me of anachronism. Hopefully not too many of those in this room. Nevertheless makes the attempt valuable for us in this room is that Virchow's starting point was health, specifically a typhus epidemic. In that report, he was widening his own vision outward from the medical profession's traditional purview to set what he was seeing within notions of a larger, quite divided society that, according to intellectual historians of the period, was at this time just coming into focus, just being articulated. Resource curse literature, on the other hand, takes as its starting point a single ecological fact, the presence of oil riches within a nation. It originates, however, with card-carrying economists and quickly leaves any other ecological considerations behind. It wields this one fact to explain national differences, not just in nations' economies, but in their governance, also a host of other outcomes, with health lying pretty far down on that list. Had I more time, I'd go into the sort of conditions of possibility for this vein of thinking, but let me just jump into the theory itself for a little explication. What has sparked this debate is a claim consolidating, dispersed among economists, that many nations' politics, and especially but not exclusively in the Middle East and Africa, suffer from their abundance of resources, at least a single resource, a natural resource called oil. The central concern here, at least initially, is how often the so-called petrostates, with so much of their economy taken up by oil production, seem inclined to authoritarianism. So how does this linkage between oil riches and dictators work? Well, much of the analysis centers on natural resource rents, those often extraordinary profits that come from extracting oil or other mineral resources. When these become plentiful, especially when they pour into government coffers, perverse incentives arise that may tilt a state away from democracy, democracy being the norm in this analysis. Governing elites face less of a need for a broad tax base among the citizenry, hence less imperative to remain accountable or to provide a breadth of services, and that's where the health spending comes in when it does. They may instead concentrate, these states may concentrate energies and efforts on protecting its claims to resource rents or gobbling up more of these rents. This line of thinking has also been used to explain what we used to call, way back when, underdevelopment. For example, oil extraction often happens in enclaves that are at once geographically and economically remote from the capitals. There are few forward and backward linkages to linkages to stimulate other economic sectors. There's much talk as well as this Dutch disease, in which the higher valuation of a nation's currency from expanded oil imports impedes the competitive ability of other economic sectors and there in the nation, and thereby distorts the growth that happens. Now, while there's a suggestion in some of this literature that the curse also suppresses public spending on health, a comparison with Virchow's health-centered arguments suggests just how this literature tends to sidestep that kind of question. Now, in fairness, Virchow doesn't ask questions about any resource influence on Upper Silesia's fate. Yet he does mention kind of in passing that it was a coal-rich province, and its enduring impoverishment might fit this theory of a resource curse. But his focus falls on this province alone. What resource curse theorists would see only as an isolated enclave within those nation states that are their primary unit of analysis. Although Virchow speaks much about poverty, he never talks about a national economy. Nor, this is an era, of course, before the GNP GDP got calculated, this tally of economic activity across the whole nation. What the lower or more localized scale of Virchow's vision does allow, though, is not just an appreciation of the human health damage caused by the epidemic, but a more ecological vision of its causes, going well beyond the mere presence or absence of fossil fuels. He notes, for instance, details of the housing, the streets, the living conditions that may have made Upper Silesians so vulnerable. And when he points to this province's lack of true democracy as the root cause of these vulnerabilities, what he means is more broader and more multifarious than the democracy of the resource-cursed literature. In the latter, it means mostly a national representative government accountable through elections that are free and fair, just like those in the U.S. Ha. Virchow, on the other hand, emphasizes the democratizing that can come, for instance, from associations of workers. It operates on a local and regional as well as a national level. Indeed, the inequities faced by Upper Silesia, the province, stem, in his view, from how little consideration they've gotten from Prussia's national government. Now, more and more social scientists have undertaken to scrutinize this connection between oil riches. This is a typical argument, you see, with GNP as the only measure of prosperity or development. And there's a lot of literature on this. Just it's really expanded in the last decade. The search for counterexamples has helped unpack just when and how resource riches can become more of a blessing. And the candidates suggested include pre-existing establishment of strong democratic institutions, the relative lack of dependence on the resource sector alone, and also somewhat counterintuitively pre-existing inequality of wealth and income. And this, a lot of this looks at Latin American nations, which by some measures have the highest levels of this kind of inequality in the world. There has nonetheless not been much redress of the neglect for health questions. And when health analysts do pay attention to this literature, they can come up with some pretty powerful critiques. I'm especially impressed by an article by a Belgian medical consultant for Doctors Without Borders named Philippe Collin. He takes on this literature's preoccupation with nation-level and purely economic metrics for development, calls it reductionist, even ideological, oriented to the macroeconomic interventions favored by the international development institutions. Instead, he calls us back toward Virchow, to looking for the multiple dimensions of deprivation that make for inequalities, among which health is especially important to consider, as he puts it. He sketches out this alternative framework, and it's one that at least begins to flesh out those contentions with illness and disease that get squeezed out by the abstractions of resource-cursed literature. Now, I find his model, I have some problems with this model because of its bias toward medical care in particular. As someone who is myself, who's more interested in environmental health associated with oils development, as opposed to, say, providing antibiotics or AIDS treatment, I would put a lot more emphasis here on this, and I would draw a lot more arrows there, for one thing. But between all the impacts on the environment these people live in, I mean, most of this is health institutions that provide medical care. Well, for the few minutes remaining to me, I'm going to single out just those direct environmental effects of petroleum production in my case sites. That generated political mobilizing. By following and comparing changes in ways these impacts were dealt with, I want to offer an overview of the when and how in the oil states or provinces of Texas in the U.S. and Veracruz in Mexico. These dangers served as basis for democratizing terms. Locals came to insist on and occasion gained new rights to a healthier environment. Now, here are my two case study sites. In the early 20th century, my two regions, though they were in different countries, one north and one south of the U.S.-Mexico border, they started in circumstances sharing many similarities. Of course, there was a geological history of oil deposits, and then both became originating sites in the early 20th century for oil extraction within their respective areas. They both also drew their region's earliest oil refineries in Port Arthur, Texas, on the right, and Minatitlan on the left. All of these built and run by private companies that were turning increasingly multinational. Now, as resource-cursed theory would have it, both regions remained, at least at this moment, enclaves, considerably less developed than many other corners of their respective nations, and isolated from those linkages I talked about, forward and backward. By selling and importing their oil elsewhere, locals brought more wealth their way, but made their regional economies more oil-dependent and their state governments more dependent on taxing oil and extraction and production, oil rents. Now, assessing the degree of democracy as well as health is not exactly an easy matter, but let me suggest some areas of local concern that I've been studying offer suggestions of both. And this is specifically regarding environmental and occupational dangers. As we know from other democratic movements over the last few decades, fall of the Berlin Wall to that of the Soviet Union to that cropping up in China today, environmental degradation can also become a flashpoint for movement making and a newfound insistence on popular voices and rights. And certainly the dirtiness, contamination, as well as the working conditions involved in petroleum extraction and refining by the 1930s in these places was giving those in Port Arthur and Beaumont, as well as the counterparts in Mexico, plenty of grounds for protest. But in the conflicts in these places, though they share this parallel response and sort of environmental change, the outcome in each place proved starkly different. On occupational hazards, by the end of the 30s, the state of Texas flagged governments of Veracruz, as well as Mexico, the national government, in not having passed workers' compensation laws for oil-related ailments. On the front of environmental pollution, there was discontent that registered in Beaumont and Port Arthur, but the outcome suggests just how powerful an influence the oil companies were able to maintain. The solution they devised was this regional anti-pollution board, had town and refinery representatives on it, and was strictly voluntarist in character. Contrast that response with the one to this, of course, self-assertion by locals in Minatitlan and Coatzacoalcos, Veracruz. There, the environmental and workplace ravages from the local oil industry helped motivate a labor movement that was far more militant than that in Port Arthur at the time, and one that famously resulted in the nationalization of that industry. Compared to how similar problems were being addressed in Texas, the Mexican government solution, taking over the holdings of foreign oil companies, looks much more like a move toward greater democracy. Now it's in the control of more local people, at least, not the foreign multinationals. Well, once we move into our second period, however, that promise of greater environmental democracy in Mexico's oil region looks to have been illusory, in part because of the dynamics emphasized by this oil curse literature. While nationalization responded to local protests and upheaval, the nation-state run operation it created became a source of federal revenues, some 30% to 40% of the nation's budget. Now, while Pemex, the state oil company, offered additional health benefits for its own workers, it made only limited effort to alleviate either the occupational or the environmental dangers of oil production. Now, I can go into details, but I'm giving you a schema here. Over the 1960s into the 70s, as Pemex made the switch toward producing its own petrochemicals, it is my Mexican case study that I find lesser efforts to monitor or curb the health-related impacts of Pemex on the Coatzacoalcos region. And Mexico was coming down with a serious case, some commentators have concluded, of a resource curse. In Texas, on the other hand, the say-so of locals over environmental conditions in Beaumont, Port Arthur got louder and gained allies. The post-World War II rise of anti-pollution politics in this corner of Texas started earlier in the mid-60s, but was highlighted in 1968 when the Texas Water Quality Board fingered Port Arthur refineries for their industrial waste problems. The local health department stepped up its monitoring other activities. By the 1970s, not only had the EPA been created and empowered, this is at the federal level, but Texas had passed its own state level legislation. And it even started to compensate oil and refinery workers for their work-related disease. Why this reversal of fortunes in Texas respect for environmental rights of workers and their neighbors? Well, it had important roots in a labor movement that became more organized in the 1950s in this area. As in other parts of the nation, it was also due, I found, to suburban homeownership expanding among the families of many refinery workers. It did involve a growing reliance on gasoline, driving these suburbs and their residences. The suburban residences, but as I've argued in this recent book, not just the dreams but the popular politics of environmentalism, of rat pollution, emerge from this kind of place. And Beaumont, Port Arthur it provides a microcosm for substantiating this argument. Let me conclude with how differences between these two case studies, and I'm not going to make it up to the present, I could in the question and answer. Let me conclude with how this comparison brings out two dynamics neglected by the resource curse literature. The first is one that Virchow would find familiar in the style as well as the degree of urbanizing that went on. Mexican cities were growing the same period, but not through the same kind of suburbanizing. Coatzacoalcos expanded, but the edges of the city were where the poor went, and less likely to be property owners too. Moreover, until the 1980s and 90s, urbanization accelerated faster, much faster, in Texas cities than it did in the Veracruz state. To put this in economic terms of resource curse theory, Port Arthur and Beaumont became less and less of an enclave because of the more diverse economy and larger population that migrated their way. Another important difference between my case studies also figures little in the resource curse thesis, It's kind of on a larger scale, and just where the wealth of their respective oil industries came from. Texas's new scale of urbanizing hinged upon wealth that accumulated from oil rents available to Texas-based multinationals. These were squeezing profits from oil fields around the globe. As for Pemex, its oil fields were limited to those inside of Mexico. Not only that, but a greater portion of its wealth headed to the nation's capital rather than to the enclaves where it was produced and refined. By not recognizing such a profound difference in the origins and amount of oil wealth flowing back to these places respectively, resource curse theory obscures and even naturalizes a global pattern of divvying oil profits already in place by 1970. In this system, whatever the riches from oil claimed by governments of any nation, multinational corporations based in a handful of countries gain the lion's share. Thank you.